Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Course. This is the early Christian church. We've got some good material in store for you. You are going to love the class. I think we all can understand why maybe someone who is a Christian would take a course like this. Hey, you know, learn a little bit about your own background, right? I think we could also understand why a person interested in religion would take a course like this. Studying early Christian history gives one an opportunity to reflect on the diverse factors at work in the emergence of any religious movement. This would enrich one's understanding of the Christianity of today and give one keener insight into issues of religion and faith in general. And with regard to the history of Western civilization, Christianity is unquestionably its most significant religious movement. With regard to the world in general, despite the central importance of other religious traditions, Islam, Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity nevertheless remains the largest religion on the planet with some 2 billion adherents today. But what about a person interested in the general study of history and not necessarily religion? Would this topic be of importance to that person? And I think we could answer yes. Now, why is that? Because the Christian church has been, throughout the history of Western civilization, not just religiously the most important institution, but the most important institution of any kind. Political, economic, social, cultural. Whether we ourselves are Christian or not, we have to acknowledge that Christian beliefs and principles and ideals have colored the thoughts and feelings of Western people. For centuries, its traditions and practices have left an indelible mark not only on developments of purely religious interest, but in art and literature and science and law, politics and economics, our social world, our beliefs, values, assumptions, worldviews. Even those who have contested the claims of Christianity and rejected its tenets have been affected by what they opposed. None of the major events of history would have happened as they did had Christianity not been the dominant religion of the West. Not the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, or the feudalism of the Middle Ages, or the European Renaissance, or the rise of nationalism, or the intellectual movements of the modern age. This is a religious system that has prevailed for nearly 2,000 years. Without it, we can only guess what our world would have looked like in all these periods. We can only guess what would have happened and how we would all be very different today. But you can rest assured the difference would be radical. Whatever our beliefs, all of us today are inevitable heirs to this abundant legacy. And it's impossible to understand the cultural heritage that sustains and conditions our lives without considering the contributions of Christianity. But let's go back. Way back. As you may know, Christianity was not always so dominant. It began as a small sect within an already existing minority religion, Judaism. Its first adherents were a tiny group of uneducated and illiterate peasants in a remote and unsavory corner of the Roman Empire, who followed a virtually unknown teacher who was executed for treason against the state. It didn't look like it was going anywhere. One of the basic questions we'll be dealing with in this course is how we got from one to the other, how Christianity could have had such a stunning impact on our world after having such an unpromising beginning. We're not going to cover the entire history of the Christian religion in this course, but only its first 400 years. The formative period of Christian history, the period partially documented by the New Testament, is the most important and fundamental period in the total history of Christianity. One of the first topics we'll address is where Christianity came from. We'll identify specifically the contributions of Roman, Hellenistic, that's Greek, and Jewish religion, philosophy, politics, and culture to the development and formation of Christian thought and practice. We'll also be examining the many dimensions of early Christianity. From one point of view, it's a unique and personal experience of a person's relationship and communication with God. From another side, it's a system of beliefs or doctrinal affirmations. From still another angle, Christianity displays the characteristics of a corporate institution. And from another angle, it's a political movement. I should make it clear, though, at the outset, that this is a history course. Although this is a class about a religious movement, we're still going to approach the material from a historical perspective, not a religious one, using all the same tools that one uses in any historical investigation, no matter what the subject or the time period. So we're going to be required to make judgments about historical statements that the ancient writers make, but not judgments about the truth or falsehood of their religious beliefs apart from the history. That's not the work of a historian. Despite the importance of early Christian history in understanding Western Civ in general, it's a widely neglected area, ironically. An area little known or understood among otherwise highly educated people. Many people have vague ideas about the early Christians. Some notion maybe that they were a small persecuted minority, frequently being thrown to the lions in the Colosseum, hanging out in catacombs to avoid arrest, but a group that grew rapidly because of their fervent convictions and willingness to die for their faith. Well, in this course, we're going to explode some of the common myths and try to get as close as we can to the real history of the early Christian movement. As I hope you'll see, these matters are not only historically important, they are fascinating as well. Yet, little known outside the world of scholarship. Now, there have been several popular models of Christian history that have developed over the centuries, ever since Christian history began to be written. What I mean by models is that these are representations of how people see the church's history and development. Now, the first two models I want to show you are common religious perspectives. The last is the common scholarly historical perspective, and it might be of interest at this point to contrast them. The Orthodox model. In this model, it's assumed that the apostles, that's Jesus' original followers, took the religious instruction that they received from Jesus, all of them remembering and interpreting his teachings the same way, and then they passed those teachings on without any alterations. So, just as Jesus ordained them and gave them the truth, they in turn ordained bishops as their successors and gave them the truth. And then those bishops in turn ordained their successors and gave them the truth, and so on. So, the church's current bishops then can trace their ordination through an unbroken line going all the way back to the apostles. This is called the doctrine of apostolic succession. The gospel message, according to this model, was kept pure through this line. All of the subsequent heretical movements would then represent deviations from this pure original Christianity. Now, this model is evident in the writings of most of the church historians you'll be reading. In fact, probably all of the church historians you'll be reading, the ones who wrote in ancient times. They very much believe in it. And they present church history according to this model. But they are writing centuries after many of these things took place. And the Orthodox model conflicts with some of the historical evidence. Nowhere in the writings of the apostles, or in any contemporaneous writings, do we see apostles appointing successors to take their place after they die. Except in one case, the traitor Judas is replaced. Very early on. Now, we see the apostles appointing various church leaders, local ones, from time to time, but not as replacements for themselves. In fact, there are no apostles after the first generation. Although churches are mentioned in the early literature, they're not described as part of a religious organization that was centrally controlled from somewhere, like Rome or Jerusalem or anywhere else, but they are described as independent groups that met in believers' homes, often without any bishop nearby. The early congregations were informal faith communities. We lack evidence for a formal hierarchical organization until much later. Now, regarding the view that from the beginning there was a supreme church leader running things, we have no documentary evidence of this until several centuries after Jesus. The literary evidence suggests that it took a long time before one bishop could speak for the whole church. Even when the church began to form a hierarchy, all decisions had to be settled through argument among the leaders. That's the Orthodox model. Now, the next model I want to show you is the Protestant model. This model claims the gospel message started in a state of purity, and there was a consensus on all beliefs for a generation, but that after the apostles died, the religion gradually became corrupted, and it existed in that state for many centuries. The Protestant Reformation would then be a restoration of original Christianity. Some Protestant groups feel even that only their church has properly restored original Christianity. But it's the same basic model. The model, as you might guess, was created during the Protestant Reformation. The Protestant model also conflicts with some of the historical evidence. The early Christian literature shows that there were disagreements regarding Christian truth, even among the earliest disciples. There does not appear to have been a unified faith, even during the apostolic period. And then we get to the modern historical model. The history of the church taught by modern historians, which is based on a more thorough and critical study of the documents of the time, including the few books that made it into the Bible and the hundreds of others that were excluded, is much different from those two earlier models. This model might be said to be what early Christian history looks like without looking through rose-colored glasses. What historians say they have found is that, except for some basic foundational tenets, there was no consensus of belief among the early Christians. The written sources reveal many Christian faith groups teaching varied and, yes, conflicting views of Jesus, God, morality, religious obligations, etc. We have evidence that some Christian groups with peculiar ideas, which were found to be heretical in the 4th century, were mentioned as existing earlier, not only in the 3rd century and 2nd century, but also in the 1st century, yes, even by the New Testament itself. So this model says that there were several alternative ideas existing side by side since the days of the earliest Christians. The diversity existed both between Christian communities and within them. Christianity at first had no established orthodoxy, that's correct teaching, or orthopraxy, that's correct practice. To be sure, some held to their own beliefs as the true version. Others embraced, or at least accepted, the diversity. So according to this model, after Jesus died, the movement sent out several missions. And each of those missions had several idiosyncratic teachings. Often there were a number of Christian congregations in the larger cities with competing and conflicting messages. We don't find any evidence for an accepted central authority. The congregations were almost completely decentralized. Men and women led house churches. Now, there's still some difference of opinion whether a mainstream Christianity existed or not, meaning a majority. It's possible. But since there's no way of calculating numbers, we have no evidence of Christians taking censuses or surveys, and since later orthodoxy destroyed many documents of groups they didn't agree with, there's no way of telling for sure. Some scholars think that Orthodox Christianity was a distinct trajectory that eventually came to dominate the others, but we have no evidence that it always dominated. But don't take my or any historian's word for it. In this course, you'll be looking at the sources yourselves. I'm merely telling you ahead of time what you will most likely find if you're not predisposed to favoring one of the other models. Well, the primary goal of the historian is to understand what took place in this complex period without consciously importing later ideas or imposing later value judgments on the source materials. Well, what sources do we have? What kind of materials? Prominent Christian figures of the first few hundred years wrote over 80 Christian gospels, hundreds of epistles, and many other writings. Fundamentalist Christians today generally accept as valid for their faith only the material that forms the official canon, the four gospels, 21 epistles, and the books of Acts and Revelation, all now in the New Testament. They view this material, and only this material, as having been inspired by God and thus inerrant, not only theologically, but historically and scientifically as well. The other Christian writings are considered worthless at best, or, at worst, heretical, deceptive, and false. Well, this simplifies for them the task of determining the history of the early Christian movement. They don't have as much to look at. But historians are not at leisure to do this. Historians have to seriously examine all of the documents. So it's a lot more work. Since this is a history class, and we're going to play the historian here, we've got to do more work. The historian has to apply the principles and general rules of the historical method exactly and in their entirety to every part of history. The cornerstone of all historical science is the careful establishment of probable facts. The historian will accomplish that by a full knowledge and critical treatment of the sources. So the first principle of the true method of church history would be an objective, reasonable, an unbiased interpretation of the sources. Probably an unreachable goal, but nevertheless an ideal to shoot for. Okay? We have to do this based on the laws of historical criticism. Another characteristic which church history should have in common with every other species of history is impartiality. This means freedom from every unfounded and personal prejudice against persons or facts, and an honest willingness to acknowledge the truth as conscientious investigation has revealed it and not as one wishes it to be. Now, no one will be completely unbiased or unprejudiced, but the historian needs to try. And I hope you don't feel like I'm talking down to you by saying that. Many of you already realize this, but it has been the case that in the past, with regard to church history, people are not as likely to use the historical method on the documents. Well, what documents do we have? The people among which Christianity first spread possessed a highly developed civilization and a literature very rich in works of history. So they possessed the historical sense. And though in early Christian times there was little occasion for extended ecclesiastical historical works, nevertheless, historical records were not wholly wanting. The New Testament itself contains historical works, the Gospels being literally narratives of the life and death of Jesus. Acts of the Apostles is also found in it, and it is the earliest history of the church. Though it makes no effort to be comprehensive, it concentrates on only a few figures in the church. Unfortunately, no history of the church after Acts of the Apostles would be written again for almost 300 years. But there did develop in the meantime works describing Christian suffering, for example, like the Acts of the Martyrs, which are a type of history. Some anti-heresy writings also contained some historical information. Chronicles were compiled in the 3rd century, some fragments of which are still around. But it's only during the 4th century that ecclesiastical history, properly so-called, makes its appearance. Eusebius, the bishop of Caesarea in Palestine, is rightly styled the father of church history. We're indebted to him for a chronicle, a church history, and a biography of Constantine. The church history was an outgrowth of his earlier chronicle. It first appeared in 9 books and covered the time from the death of Christ to the victories of Constantine and Licinius in about 312 or 313. After that, Eusebius added a 10th book, which carried the narrative up to the victory of Constantine over Licinius in about 323. Another 10 years added on. Now Eusebius made use of many ecclesiastical monuments and documents, Acts of the Martyrs, letters, extracts from earlier Christian writings, lists of bishops, and similar sources, often quoting the originals at great length, so that his work contains very precious materials not preserved elsewhere. So it's of great value, although it doesn't pretend to be complete or to observe due proportion in the treatment of the subject matter. But that's why I'm having you read Eusebius for this class. Very valuable work. He has sometimes been accused of intentional falsification of the truth, but I think that is rather an unjust accusation. Certainly we can admit that in judging persons or facts, he's not entirely unbiased. And he's been rightly censured for his partiality towards Constantine the Great and his glossing over of that emperor's faults. But he does appear to at least be trying, to some extent. Eusebius found several imitators in the first half of the 5th century. The earliest is that of the Latin scholar Rufinus, who translated Eusebius into Latin and wrote an extension of Eusebius' history, weaving many documents into his very clear, well-written narrative. Regrettably, other general narratives of church history in this period have been lost, such as there was a history written by a presbyter named Philip of Side, he was from Pamphylia. And there's a church history by a Neo-Arian named Philostorgius. Now, the good news about Philostorgius is we do possess a summary of his church history, and that's another book that I signed for the class, the summary of Philostorgius' history. It doesn't have his exact words, but it tells you what his church history is about, and so we're going to look at that as well. There were others written too. About the middle of the 5th century, the church history of Eusebius was continued by three writers, almost simultaneously. This just shows the esteem in which they held Eusebius' work. All three of these continuations of Eusebius have reached us complete. The first was written by Socrates Scholasticus, who is from Constantinople, and he expressly says that he's continuing Eusebius' work, and he describes in 7 books the period from about 305 to 439. And it's a work of great value. The author is very honest. He exhibits critical acumen in the use of his sources, and he has a clear and simple style. He's another guy I'm having you read for the class, Socrates Scholasticus. After him comes Sozomen, also from Constantinople, and his work runs from about 324 to 425, but it's inferior to that of Socrates. I will talk about him from time to time, but he's not as good. And then there was Theodoret, the bishop of Cyrus. And Theodoret wrote a continuation of Eusebius, and he covers the period from about 320 to about 429. I will occasionally refer to him as well. Now, those are our church histories. But they are all faith documents produced by believers for believers to promote belief. How then can these faith documents be used as historical sources? Aren't they going to be biased? Well, hey, every document is biased in some way or another. And it's the historical method that's going to help us to sift through all of the things that they say to figure out what we can trust more and what we can trust less. So now I want to tell you a little bit about historical methodology. And this applies, of course, to any area of history, but it's a good reminder when we're discussing church history, because again, people are less tending to use historical method when it comes to church history. So it's a good reminder, and I want to just go over a few basic points. When events occur, they can be known by contemporaries who then pass on their knowledge and understanding to others. In our daily life, people accept that knowledge of events can be passed on from the witnesses of those events. Oh, did you hear what happened last night at the bar? Oh, man. And then we Of course, we take into account if the person was drunk, but you know what I'm saying. Anyway, in a court of law, even more officially, right, through the testimonies of witnesses to a particular event, facts can be established beyond a reasonable doubt. Well, the historical sources that we have for church history are witnesses, right, that provide testimony. The aim of the historical methodology is to determine if the various testimonies that reach us today can be accepted as sound evidence. Once a historian has collected all of his sources, anything that directly or indirectly provides information about a particular event, whether it be a book, a scroll, a broken piece of pottery, a picture, an oral tradition, whatever, he must then evaluate them using the techniques of historical criticism. Now, let me just say something about the word criticism. It has a negative connotation in our everyday language. Oh, you're criticizing that, you know. That's not really what it is with historical criticism. Criticism with history is not really about finding out what is wrong with a source. It's actually about finding out what is right with it. Let me explain. There are two main kinds of criticism when it comes to sources: external criticism and internal criticism. Let me tell you about each. External criticism involves investigating the origin of a particular source. Where did it come from? So it's not about its content. That's what internal criticism does. It's about where it came from. All right? The historian needs to seek out all possible information regarding the source's origin, right? As well as possibly, if it can be done, restoring the source to its original form if it's been altered in any way. So we have to determine the authenticity of a source. Was it really written by the person to whom it is attributed? Does it really belong in the period to which it claims to belong? Now, you might say, well, why wouldn't it? Well, in ancient times especially, in the Greco-Roman world, pseudepigraphy was common. What's pseudepigraphy? It's basically pseudonymity. It's when somebody writes a work in somebody else's name. Okay? This is something that was done in those days. For example, student exercises in school, sometimes it would include aping famous authors, you know. Pretend you're so-and-so. Now, what would you say if you wrote this or whatever? And apocalyptic literature in the Jewish and Christian traditions tended also to use pseudonymity. Be a famous person from the past, like the Book of Enoch or something like that. Like, you're Enoch and you wrote this. But obviously you weren't Enoch, okay? But everybody knew that, really, okay? Nevertheless, pseudepigraphy was common, so we have to be careful. Oh, this says so-and-so wrote it. Did so-and-so really write it? We have evidence for pseudepigraphic works right in the New Testament itself. So let me give you an example. This is from the second letter to the Thessalonians. All right, in this letter, it's said to be from Paul, Silvanus, and Timothy, right? Now in chapter 2, verse 2, starting in verse 1, the latter half of it, "We beg you, brothers," they write, "not to be quickly shaken in mind or alarmed, either by spirit or by word or by letter, as though from us, to the effect that the day of the Lord is already here." As though from us. You notice that? Claiming to be from them. Now look at chapter 3, verse 17, the very end of the letter. "I, Paul, write this greeting with my own hand. This is the mark in every letter of mine. It is the way I write." Notice an effort is being made there at the end of the letter to show this is truly from me. It's not spurious. Okay? So even in New Testament times, there were people writing Christian letters claiming to be other people. Now, sometimes it may have been deliberate to fool people. Okay? Other times, they do it more as a style of writing. It's the genre. It's just what people do, like I mentioned with apocalyptic literature, something like that. It isn't, you know, meant to deceive necessarily. People kind of know. All right? But it does exist, and it can throw historians off. So we have to determine the authenticity of a source. Another part of external criticism consists of an examination of the source's integrity. In other words, it has to be ascertained whether that text has been corrupted in any way. Did somebody add to it, subtract from it, make some changes? Only then can we start looking at the witness, at the witness's testimony. Okay, if changes have been made, we have to, you know, get rid of the corrupting parts, if we can. That sometimes it's very difficult to know. If we have a lot of copies of a document, it's much easier. Internal criticism is concerned with the content of the source. All right. So what about the content? Well, the historian, first of all, has to be sure to understand what the witness means by his testimony. What did he mean when he said that? Now, given that language is constantly in a state of change, determining the true meaning of a testimony is not an easy task. Oftentimes, words are not used literally, and new meanings become attached to them. The historian needs to figure out the meaning which the author or witness attaches to those particular words if we're going to understand the testimony. So a historian needs to be familiar with the idioms used at the time of the source's origin. And obviously the historian must be fluent in the language used in the source and trained in philology to undertake this task. All right, these things were written centuries ago by people who wrote a different language. Okay, in order to understand the testimony, we have to know what kind of person or people created the source, what their attitudes and interests were, what is their education, what is their position in life, what were their political views, what kind of character did they have, how old were they, what kind of temperament did they have. It's also important to know how and why the particular source came about. Why did they write this, and for whom was it written? And then the historian needs to establish the credibility of the witness. That means, you know, establishing whether he was competent. Does he speak out of knowledge? Whether he's truthful. Here are some common sources of error. At the top of the list, faulty memory. All right? Prejudices. These are weaknesses that every person has. Another challenge might be a defective sense of observation. Okay? Sometimes those things can easily lead to misunderstandings on the part of the writer. We should consider a few methodological principles that should be applied to our sources when we're thinking of this. First of all, historical sources that are closest to an event have a greater likelihood of being accurate than those at a further remove. And that's logical, right? When you're dealing with ancient sources here, if you give time for reports about an event to circulate, there's more opportunity for the report to change. And the longer it goes, the more chances of change, right? Eventually, everyone's going to get the story wrong. It's not a hard and fast rule, okay? But, you know, sometimes later sources can recount events more accurately than earlier ones. But generally speaking, it is the case. The closer it is to the event, the better. We also have to be alert to later developments, for example, with theological views in the tradition that has affected our sources, right? A greater passage of time allows greater sustained theological reflection. Great changes in opinion are not usually made all of a sudden and never by large bodies of people. So history that represents those changes being made gradually and by easy steps is usually the more probable, okay? The common people in any country don't really speculate all that much, and they are less likely to make changes. They retain their opinions the longest, in other words. So we always look for the oldest opinions among the common people, and not among the learned, who they like to come up with new ideas all the time. In many cases, we're going to see words put into the mouths of historical figures, and our question has to be not whether the religious views put into their mouths are true, but whether those words actually came out of their mouths. You know what I'm saying? So-and-so wrote something and said, oh, Jesus said this, or so-and-so said this. Okay? Are they putting words in their mouth? We should also be aware of the bias found in each author. All right? In the sources, we see a tendency for every story to drive home, either subtly or obviously, the same few points. Whenever we can determine an author's biases, we can then take them into consideration when analyzing his report. So, you know, it's natural for people who wish to speak disparagingly of any religious sect to undervalue that sect's numbers, as well as everything else related to that sect. And it's equally natural for those who wish to speak respectfully or honorably of a certain party to represent the members of it as more numerous than they are and as better. And, you know, so we have to take that into consideration too. All right. Finally, I want to talk about some criteria for determining credibility in the sources. We have some criteria that we can use, and these are common in any field of history, not just in church history. But I want to show you how they can be used for our purposes here. One criterion, the most widely used, you might say, is the criterion of independent attestation. One helpful way to think about this criterion is to compare the work of a historian to a prosecuting attorney, right? He tries to establish what actually happened in the past. It's better to have a number of witnesses who can provide consistent testimony than to have only one witness, especially if the witnesses can be shown not to have conferred with one another to get their story straight. So that's what this criterion is. An event mentioned in several independent documents is more likely to be historically accurate than an event that's mentioned in only one document. That's not to deny that an individual document can provide reliable information. It can, but without corroborating evidence, it's impossible to know. Did he make it up? We don't know. If a tradition is preserved in more than one document, no one of them could have made it up because they all independently seem to know about it. All right? So that's good. All right. This criterion does not work for sources that aren't independent. So, for example, if Socrates, Scholasticus, and Sozomen both get a piece of information from Eusebius, you can't say, oh, there's two sources. Socrates says it, Sozomen says it. Oh, and the third source, Eusebius, says it. There's three. It's not really three. It's only one because it comes from Eusebius, and the other two just got it from him. All right? So that's not independent. So we have to keep that in mind, too. A second criterion, might call this the criterion of similarity. And this criterion assumes that information provided in both sources that are favorable to a person or a movement and sources antagonistic towards a person or a movement is highly likely to be authentic. In other words, if a friend of Christianity says it and a foe of Christianity says it, it's more likely to be true. All right? Because it comes from both sides. Both sides are saying it. All right? A third criterion is what we call the criterion of dissimilarity. Again, using my analogy of a legal case, any witness in court will naturally tell things the way he or she sees them. Sometimes a witness, though, has a vested interest in the outcome of the trial, right? So he might skew his testimony a little bit. So here's the criterion. If the witness testifies counter to his or her vested interests, that testimony is more likely to be true. All right? So, what if a saying or a deed attributed to a historical figure does not obviously support a Christian cause, and yet it is stated in a document that's pro-Christian? All right? A Christian wouldn't generally make up a story that doesn't support his agenda or even works against his agenda. That's even better to say. If he writes something that works against his own agenda, it's unlikely that he made it up. That's what we're looking for, right? Did he make it up? People make up things that go with their agenda. So if it goes counter to his agenda, then he probably didn't make it up. That's the criterion of dissimilarity. Okay? The same would apply to outside sources. If an enemy of Christians testifies counter to his invested interests, that testimony is also likely to be more true. All right? Okay. Then we've got the criterion of accidental information. We often find out useful, reliable details from what the sources give away in passing. In other words, they're things about which the writers have no axe to grind. They just happen to mention it in passing. It's accidental information. Oh, by the way, blah, blah, blah. And they mention it in passing. Those details are usually reliable. They're more reliable. Okay? Because they're not likely to make that up because it's not really about what they're talking about. It's not on their agenda either, right? So, for example, like, Jesus was a carpenter. You know, that doesn't really go with any agenda. They just happen to mention that on the side. Or that he had a house in Capernaum. You know, it's not really a big thing. It just happened on the side. They're just mentioning it. Those things are more likely to be true. And then finally, the criterion of contextual credibility. And this one is the only one that I've mentioned here that it actually determines what is less likely to be true. All the other ones, that's what's more likely to be true. Here's something about rooting out certain things. All right. The sayings and deeds and experiences of a historical person have to be plausibly situated in the historical context if they're going to be trusted as reliable. Right? The logic of that principle can again be explained in terms of a judicial proceeding. In a court of law, the testimony of a witness will not hold up under cross-examination if it doesn't coincide with the rest of the facts of the case. Same thing here. If we have, you know, a document that says 250 BC on it, we know there's a problem because in 250 BC, they didn't have that form of dating. It's an anachronism. Same thing as if we read about how, you know, Jesus had an iPod or something, you know. It doesn't fit the historical context. All right? So in this case, if it goes against the historical context, it's less likely to be accurate. Here is an important point that I want to make about history in general. With respect to any historical person, the historian can do no more than establish probabilities. In no case can we reconstruct the past with absolute certainty. All we can do is take the evidence that happens to survive and determine to the best of our abilities what probably happened. After the historian has sifted through the sources and rigorously applied the rules of external and internal criticism, then he or she is ready to draw some conclusions. The ordering and synthesizing of all the materials into the correct reconstruction of event is a very challenging task that involves interpretation on the part of the historian. Right? The manner in which we interpret our reliable sources shapes our reconstruction of an event. I want you to think about that as you read the source material for this course. Next time, we're going to discuss the background of Christianity, and first and foremost, the Jewish background. So, we'll see you next time.